Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Michael Adams here. Welcome to the penultimate episode of our Super League series. It is the last interview we'll do for this series, so fittingly it is with Two Tribes author and friend of the show, Steve Mascord. So this is one we'd penciled in long ago. Last time we had him on, I said that I couldn't read Two Tribes until we completed our research. And now that we've done that, I've read and thoroughly enjoyed the book. Anyone who hasn't also done the same, please get a copy. It's a fantastic story. Compliments our telling of the story really well. Some fascinating insight, great stories, amazing interviews. Can't recommend Two Tribes highly enough, and really thankful to Steve for all he's done through his writings over the years that really formed our show, and then for agreeing to come on the show and talk some Super League with us. So thanks, Steve. I hope you enjoy the interview. Before we get to it, the business I really want to tell you all about, I'm very excited to announce our Rugby League Digest Wrap Party. So you'll be hearing the last episode we do in the next couple of weeks. And following that, we, Andy and I, would love to join you for a beer at Hotel Sweeney's on Saturday, June 8th from 3 p.m. So a full slate of Super Saturday games on the big screen. We'll be on level two. We're taking over the level. And I've had the privilege to meet and have a beer with quite a few listeners over the years. I'd love to see all of you who I have done so before at Hotel Sweeney's, but also, even more importantly, all the great listeners we have who I haven't got the chance to meet and thank for your support. I'd really appreciate the opportunity to do so. So please come along, 3 p.m. At Hotel Sweeney's on Saturday, June 8th. It's a free event, but just to keep track of numbers, I've created an Eventbrite page. So if you're interested in coming along, look for the link to that event in the description of this episode, or you can see it on our socials as well. But yeah, please, would love to see as many of you there as possible. So with that said, I hope you enjoy this interview with Steve, and we'll be back with the conclusion of the Super League series very soon. Welcome back to the Rugby League Digest. I'm Michael Adams. I'm not here with Andrew Paskin tonight, but I have a more than capable replacement, and this is something that I've been looking forward to for some time. The return of our fellow traveller in Super League, it's Steve Mascord. How are you, Steve?
Good, mate. I want to straight off the bat, you're in an unusual situation where you bought a book very early, but you read it very late. So you got I corrected a lot of typos and stuff. So I want to apologize to you and anyone who's listening I think we're up to the third edition now. And the fourth edition, I'm going to add a few things that you brought up that I overlooked, like the test series that year. The ARL, no, the Super League test that Australia and New Zealand played before Australia came over to the UK. Mm. I completely overlooked that in the book. And there's a couple of other things. So anyway, for those of you who supported the project from the start and you got a few typos, I apologize, but there's an audio book coming out soon. And obviously the Kindle is updated with, as many of the typos fixed as possible. So anyway, just thank you. And thanks to everyone listening who supported the book. Thank you.
And hopefully we can get those last few stragglers who haven't picked it up yet, because I'm going to just give you a little bit of my experience reading the book at last, Steve, because last time I spoke to you, which was just after the book came out, I mentioned that I wasn't going to read it until we got through our 1997. And so I've you know, got 4 million or so words of research notes. This has been a mammoth project that has consumed my life. I love reading, and in the past 5 or 6 years, I've got to do very little of it. And I've been anticipating the day where I could read for pleasure again. And then I finally finish all this research about the Super League War. And what's the first thing I pick up? It's Two Tribes. And so I started reading it, and it at the start, I'm not going to lie, it felt like homework. It felt like I was going through something that I just spent my life reliving. And the other part of that was, I was also like very nervous about, oh no, have we got something completely wrong? And then, you know, you've corrected the record. So there was this trepidation as well. And it took me a while to get into it, to the point where it eventually stopped being homework and it started being something that I was just really riveted by. And there's a particular pivot point, which I'll get to later in our discussion. But by the end, I loved it so much. And I, again, viewing it through my own selfish lens of our show, I found it like so complimentary. Like some of the interviews that you got added context to things that we talked about, and so many new great stories. And it was just a real thrill to read. So congratulations on a you know, wonderful achievement. It's a really super book.
Oh, thanks. That's very, very kind of you. I'd like to think that it still has a bit of a life. When I was back in Australia last, I spoke to a guy who optioned it, and then for a film or documentary or whatever. And I did an interview for a documentary as well, which must have scared the hell out of some people in their Qantas seats. Some people said I was switching channels in my Qantas seat, and I still haven't seen it. I'm not sure I'm in a hurry to see it either, but I got a haircut especially for the interview. But yeah, I hope it's still got a life. And, you know, I am doing, I'm going to add some, like Tony Butterfield contacted me also about the alleged brawl in the Cricketers' Arms, you know, between Mark Sargent, or threatened brawl between Mark Sargent and Paul Harrigan in Grand Final.
Mal Reilly, wasn't it?
Yeah, Mal Reilly. Mal Reilly. That's right. Mal Reilly and Mark Sargent. Sorry, Chief. Chief were talked about breaking them up.
Yeah.
So he was there. But, you know, Tony Butterfield contacted me and wanted to correct that. And then, as I said, that's another thing, the test match that I neglected to mention that you mentioned. And so I'm definitely going to do like another edition. I think that will be third or fourth, I think. So I'm going to correct the, but also I'd like, the thing is like, I won't mention the guy's name who I spoke to about optioning it. He's a film producer and stuff. But he said, well, mate, it's like this. Succession is actually about the Murdochs, but they're not allowed to call them Murdochs because of legal reasons. So he's like, well, we can't actually, we can go one of, you know, if we're going to do this, we're going to dramatize this, we've got to change everyone's name, really, because you can't, you know, you just, it's just too complex legally. So, you know, the last thing the people involved got in contact with me a couple of weeks ago and said, do you know any organized crime connections? And like, you know, because of the kind of Golden Mile, you know, one of the, that sort of true crime genre is very big at the moment. And I said, well, you know, John Elias was at the time, you know, and he went to jail. So I think I can legally say that he was, it's on the public record that he mixed in bad company at times, John. So, aside from that, I don't know of any, but I'm sure there's plenty there. Maybe you can help in that area. But I do hope it's got a life. And I've said that I'm going to start doing stuff, do something on the 94 Kangaroos, and which brings us back to before we're on air, that you started by talking about 94. So I'll be listening to that again. And everyone is now on rugbyleague.com listening to it as we speak. So, yeah, I hope it's still got a life. And it makes me go back and think about, you know, if – like, should I try it harder to get a publisher, you know, so it would be more mainstream? You know, what could I – there's some definite things I would do differently this time, as I learned from the first book when I did this one. So, yeah, it's been great. It's been a great experience. And the best thing about it was, you know, I said I was going to do a book launch in every town that had a team. And in 1997, I think I've still got about 12 book launches to go. So I'm looking forward to coming back and maybe launching the audio book in at Campbelltown.
Yeah,
and places like that, you know. So Sir George Legs Club, or launch the 12th edition just so I can have a piss up. So no, it was a great experience, mate, and I appreciate your support and to everyone listening, you know.
And I think you're right, Steve, about it having legs. And to set this up, I'm going to read, I want to start this interview with the start of your book, which in many ways leads us to the end. But this is where we're going to start. You wrote, "My objective in Two Tribes is somewhat lofty. I want the game to make its peace with 1997. I want to give a human face to sport's lowest point since its birth in England 100 years before, to tell how a peculiar melange of personalities, technological advances, commercial pressures and rivalries produced a season that was bizarre, eventful, side-splittingly funny, and yeah, sometimes shambolic and tragic." When I read that, my ears immediately, or my eyes immediately pricked up, as it were. I haven't got the audiobook yet. But it made me think your objective to the game to make its peace with 1997, that's like almost precisely the point that me and Andy started at, where we were like thinking about Super League and the fact that it was just not talked about. It was like the game hadn't grappled with it. And I've found over the course of your book coming out, I'll give ourselves a bit of credit as well. I think kind of, you know, shows like, you know, The Fan with Vossi and Fox actually starting to show the odd Super League game. I feel like from where it was, say, 5 or 6 years ago, to where it is now, like it feels like there's a bit of a groundswell and a bit of momentum behind Super League and the game actually finally making peace with it.
Well, mate, I listened to a podcast called the Rugby League Chronicles when we were setting up this radio station, this online radio station, and I, you know, when we went to air, I don't know what you, I don't think we're actually broadcast through the air yet. A few weeks ago, I thought it was still a current podcast, but it turns out they haven't done an episode in more than a year. And you're kind of like Nirvana; they're like Pearl Jam or Alice in Chains. You know what I mean? Like you've actually inspired a bit of a scene. You know, where people want to examine this. You know, and I also think it speaks to the kind of, I don't want to get too kind of philosophical or deep, but it speaks to the kind of people who are rugby league fans who didn't previously have a voice and were very much in the minority, which, you know, later in the book I attempt to get a little bit philosophical too about that, about the rugby league left and the rugby league right. And the rugby league left never really had a voice, but now they're I think they're almost the dominant like group in the game, almost like the people, rugby league fans are more aspirational and outward looking. The mainstream in Australia, infinitely more than they were when I was a kid, and even when you were a kid, which was after I was a kid by a little bit. So a lot of things are changing. Not only that, I did a thing on Vegas, and I actually think the changes that I described, the cultural aspect of 1997, and the lessons that I learned anyway, maybe we should have learned about ourselves in 97. You know, I thought that they were immutable, that was just the way we are and they can never change. And you know, I think even the needle has moved there, you know, when I went to Las Vegas for a lot of complicated reasons. But I don't know, we can go into that later if you like. But I think things have, since you started your podcast and since I started the book, you know, a lot of things in rugby league culture have changed, I think, for the better, you know?
Yeah, and I really liked it. I think it might have even been the preceding paragraph or section from that quote I just read, where you mentioned that the four types of fans in terms of Super League, and one of them were the train spotters. And instantly I was like, oh, yes, that's the tribe we've found. And I think of, you know, various Twitter accounts and jersey obsessives and, you know, the likes of Stephen Russo and my mate Guy Wilson, who moved to Adelaide a few years ago, and not ironically, but just as a rugby league enthusiast, started thinking about the Rams, and that's you know, evolved into this full-blown obsession. So
I know Guy. Not only do I know Guy well, and he came to the book launch in Adelaide, but I think I'm about to go and pick up, you know, I'm still sort of doing the merch, even though I'm really busy at the moment. So my merch is, I think I'm actually going to fly to Sunshine Coast, rent a car, go and pick it all up from Rob Bergen's place and take it to Guy. I think it's going to be a great, because Guy wants to get involved in doing RAM stuff. And so I've spoken to him about, you know, as part of that, can I give you these other few boxes of stuff? Because I need someone to post stuff out in Oz. That's what it's kind of led to. And I'm sure with you, it's led to a lot of new friendships and stuff like that.
I think you're so right that there's a voice and there's outlets for like all, I think when Andy and I started, it was one of our big complaints that there just wasn't enough like stuff out there to service like everything about rugby league. Like it's such a great game, such a rich history. And we always got such a narrow segment of it.
Yeah. And I think that's, again, you know, Super League happened because of technological changes. And I think that has happened because of a technological change as far as DIY media and social media, where people who think that their view or their perspective isn't represented, they can just go, and make a podcast, start a YouTube channel, whatever like that. And, you know, like just doing this radio station. By the way, we're just doing audio, aren't we? Because I'm actually, if we were doing video, I'm looking away at Penrith versus South, which is going to date this audio, but anyway.
Don't worry, just audio.
I was going to say, it kind of like it's driven by this by these technological changes, just the same as the Super League War was. But the Super League War was actually about warehousing content and the value of that content and denying it to people. And now our craze about that era is being powered by the opposite process, which is people creating independent media and really the value of what I'm watching over here is in the NRL, it's gone down during COVID, and we don't know if it's gone down in real terms. And in Super League, it's been cut in half. So the thing that they fought over 25 years ago is its future is uncertain, I would say. You know, traditional TV rights for sport. So technology has, as I said, it's allowed us to sit here and do this. So it's quite a tangled web.
Yeah.
No pun intended, you know. Yeah.
To look at that question more philosophically, that idea of the game making peace with Super League, where do you think we are in that process?
Yeah, I think there's two parts to that question. One is how the league and the administration, how they rank those. You know, I had a conversation with someone on, it might have been Andrew Ferguson on Rugby League Project about, I really dislike people's, you know, former NRL player Mark Coyne. I really hate that. You know, like he might have, did he have a year? You don't think, anyway. No, 99. Yeah, he would have had a couple of years in NRL. Yeah. So he's a bad example. Former NRL player Les Boyd.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I just despise that. It was, you know, the premiership is a cover all. You know what I mean? So I think people still need some sort of, they need people to put well-argued positions to them if they haven't thought about these things before. So I think the NRL, for instance, I mean, when Terry Hill died, what sport doesn't include World Cup appearances as international caps? Only Australia and rugby league. Mm. You know what I mean? Like in the 1995, and in many, we're going down a rabbit hole now, but in many ways that was like, people said people only went to Super League for money, but the people who went to Super League thought that was ridiculous, that the Australian rugby league thought that Russia was such a joke or whatever, so we were not going to count them as test caps. So the people who thought that was a joke and were more outward looking, and they were more likely to be caught up in Super League and attracted to Super League because it represented all those other things. So I think the people who run the sport, you know, they still haven't kind of, maybe they don't quite represent that year as the way we would like them to. And I think the people in who are fans, there's still a huge spectrum of opinions and the ways they view it, isn't there?
Yeah.
You know, there's probably more people who kind of say, there's more people than there was who say, yeah, there were two grand finals. Yeah, there were interstate games that year that weren't Origin games, you know. And there are more people than there were when you first started doing your podcast and I first started doing my book. But there's still a lot of people who are fighting in the jungle and say it were, Murdoch was scum, and none of the games counted, and none of the internationals counted, and the ARL was the only real rugby league. There's still a lot of those people out there. So, I think we've got more people who are kind of like moderates now. That's probably the answer to your question. I think there are more people who kind of sit in the middle and are moderates than there was before. But that could also be the passing of time, just the passing of time, that enmities tend to sort of flicker and die with the passing of the years. So, I think, and then there's that small, and there is a growing group who romanticized the year, which I think is down to you and the fact that the interest that you attracted on your show. So, to answer your question, I think the administration are doing a better job of recognizing the period, but not a great job. And I think there are more moderates and more romantics and trade spotters than there were. And then the other groups still exist,
yeah.
Really, you know?
Yeah. I think the storytelling is so crucial. Like, whether you think Super League was good or bad, it's something that happened, and it was,
yeah,
like, you know, for you as a journalist at the time, it was like, you know, it was great, you know, like a great period to be a journalist. For people looking at it historically, like, so many great stories, like, to me, we'll only have truly grappled with Super League when it becomes, you know, like Sattler's Jaw. It's just part of the DNA, yeah, of rugby league history. And
and
I feel the more stories we get, the closer we get to truly accepting it.
Yeah, couldn't say it better myself. All those Jason Deeth's helicopter and all that sort of stuff. I wouldn't say Jason Deeth and the helicopter should be up there with Sattler and his jaw. I wouldn't like to see a statue made of that or anything like that. But yeah, no, you're 100% correct. And all the people who, yeah, a lot of the people who, like, I think, who was it, Neil Cadogan, who said, most of the people at the coalface tended to make friends pretty quickly when it was over. And it was the people on the other side of the fence, in his case, literally, the other side of the fence, his neighbour on the Central Coast, who tended to keep up the anger and and maintain the rage, you know. And, you know, whatever makes you passionate, I guess, is good. But then, you know, it's very interesting to talk about it in terms of where we might be headed. You know, like, the international game was such a big bargaining chip in the Super League war. What a pass I just saw. I think it was Taruva, quick pass. The international game was such a big bargaining chip, and you would just laugh now if you said, I'm going to start a new competition in Australia and I've got Super League on my side.
Yeah.
You imagine the look on Volandi's face or Abdo's face if you did that, you know. So now we kind of have the power bases have changed, and the structures of the sport worldwide have changed. So I think we are going to see some big schisms again, you know, in the years ahead, not with a rebel competition in Australia, but with other things around the fringes. And I think the Super League War is going to inform that. And I think people will talk about the Super League War a lot more. So I think the storytelling is going to continue.
Mm. I was going to do this at the end, but we're on it now. There's something I've been thinking about in anticipation of this interview and thinking about our own series wrapping up, is that I feel like we're kind of at a point, whether it's been forced by, you know, bigger events, whether it's, you know, vision within the administration, I don't know, but I feel like it's a time for bold ideas that we haven't really seen since, you know, the late 80s into the early 90s with expansion and then into Super League. Like, we've seen, you know, the Dolphins come into it. We've seen an American expedition that, you know, we'll see where we are with that in 3 years, but it seems for the first time there's a bit of follow-up at least, and, you know, rule changes. It seems like there's some bold ideas happening, where I feel for a long time rugby league was in a quite a conservative kind of process.
Yeah, well, I think that I tried to make some observations about that, you know, about that rugby league, you know, argue that rugby league isn't just a working class game. It's an extension of the working class. It exists purely because of the working class. You know what I mean? So it can't do anything that the working class can't do, and I quite pessimistically said it never will be able to. But there's two factors which I think may have changed it. One is that your average working class person in the eastern seaboard of Australia can afford to save up 10 grand and go to America for a week now. And secondly, and whether he intends to do this or not, Peter Volandis talks the language of the rugby league right. You know, bloody aerial ping pong, or Perth's too far away on a plane, you know, which is just outrageous to me. But yeah, just all these sort of things. But he does the opposite. So he actually kind of has, and also through COVID and stuff, he has bought himself a license that no rugby league administrator has ever had. He's bought himself the license. He basically sort of talks like Arco and acts like Rebo. You know what I mean? So he's actually been able to break down this sort of ceiling, this glass ceiling that's been there since 1895. You know, it's been like, you know, don't get too uppity. And also, we need money. You know, we can't have teams here, there, or whatever, because we need away fans. We need to buy a pie and a beer, and you know, we're going to go broke next week if they don't bring any away fans. All this sort of stuff that rugby league is kind of built on. He's kind of bought himself the license to break it, but also he pretends he's not breaking. He pretends he built the glass ceiling himself. You know, sort of pretends he built the glass ceiling. You know, while he's smashing it with a hammer. I actually think that, and I talked about, you know, again, my metaphors might be tiresome and labored and childish, but I talked about an atom where, you know, the atom at the center of rugby league that makes us love it also holds it back because it's so tied to community and identity and class and family and location and geography. And so if you try to kind of, grow one half of it, which is the exciting, flashy, fancy thing. If you try to make too big a deal of that, then you kill the patient in the operation, you know, and that's what kind of happened in the Super League where people were like, if it wasn't for Newcastle still having that link to all those things because it was a new club, because they never won a comp, the people still connected what was happening that year to what they knew, then, you know, you could have killed the patient in the operation being the World Club Challenge with Halifax playing Perth and the New Zealand in the state of origin and all these sort of things. Those things could have killed the patient, you know. And so I thought when I was writing the book that this was just an eternal truth for rugby league. For rugby league to survive, it couldn't really ever leave the cradle. It had to have a foot in the cradle at all times. And then I sat there with 40,000 other people at the home of the Super Bowl, and watched two teams from 1908, one from one from 1947 and one from 1988, play each other, went for a walk and bumped into Laurie Daly holding a beer, and I was like, actually, it is possible, and it's possible because. You know, may not without COVID, even without him buying that imprimatur from people, even though he gave a bunch of money back to Channel 9 and they gave it to Rugby Union, which people forget. But you know, without him buying that imprimatur from people and without the kind of Orwellian sort of doublethink of saying one thing and doing the opposite, we would never have got there. And I kind of thought maybe, you know, I wrote a piece, I thought maybe the atom got split, you know, in Las Vegas, not because it was a successful venture, but because a rugby league was able to do something with the support of its core constituents that it was never able to do before. How many times have we gone to America? You know, 1951 and all that sort of stuff, and 1987, and you know, Warrington versus Wigan in Milwaukee, and all these things that we did and never followed up, and we were never able to do those things. And I kind of think maybe the glass ceiling, you know, has now. Been broken. It's a long way of answering your question, but yeah. So I think so much has happened. We've gone, you know, from vinyl to CD to MP3 to cloud. You know, almost since you started your podcast and my book came out almost. You know.
Well, I think that's a good good time to let you know the pivot point for me where the book really became something that I could just sit and enjoy independently and be really captivated by was the Rebo chapter, because I find him, like, you know, maybe the most compelling figure in the whole saga. And I find the Rebo from 1988 to 1994, or really the Rebo from 1988 to March 31, 1995, is kind of different to the Rebo we got ever since. Like, the pre-Super League, he's just raining body blows on the ARL. He's like, he's got these bold ideas, you know, yes, self-serving for Brisbane, but with, you know, with kind of facts behind it and an idea of something bigger for the game. And then Super League comes along, and he was, you know, he seems able to withstand the public vitriol that he copped, but something shifted, and suddenly he was, you know, making gaffes in the press. And I don't know how much of it was just that the what he was selling just wasn't the right product, but it just, you know, something shifted with Rebo. And I just found your chapter on him just really interesting.
Yeah, like let's say, I'm thinking, like, trying to think of like a pet project, right? So let's say I argue, which I do, that rugby league should do more with nines, and we should have a world circuit, and it's ridiculous that we don't. And even, like, I went to Nines last weekend in Coventry, and I'm going to go to Nines on Sunday in Warrington, because I do actually believe that stuff. And the two competitions are not linked in any way. It's a mere coincidence that one team is playing in both women's on Sunday. So let's say I keep saying this at meetings and blah, 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 and no one listens to me. They all think Nines is a joke. And the IRL, I think a lot of administrators don't think there's much future in Nines. The IRL have basically said that they're not interested in it anymore. So, and suddenly, like, Rupert Murdoch or someone or Disney Plus say, I get introduced to someone at Disney Plus, and I argue that Nines is the future, and they go, great, we'll give you $100 million. We'll launch a Nines World Circuit. You know, then what happens? It's like, I want to be a rock star. You become one. Can I handle being a rock star? You know what I mean? I'm watching the Bon Jovi documentary at the moment, 4-part. Very good. So I think that's kind of what happened. Like, I think John had very, you know, thick skin, and he was able to deal with the kind of personal fallout of, you know, he was very offended when Roy wrote that thing about the Anzac test. So he wasn't 100% capable. He had weak spots, but he believed and he believed. And then it got to the point where it was taken out of his hand. So we have a Nines World Circuit for a year. You know, that super we nick a bunch of Super League players from over here, and then they make a deal with IMG, and they go back in. And where does that leave me as the guy who went to all the meetings and said you should do more with Nines? And maybe there's no more Nines. They decide we're not going to do that anymore. We're going to do tens or something. Yeah. Then what do I do? What do I do? Maybe Disney Plus give me start a club and give me a club to run. You know, so I'm appreciated. You know, like so I think the thing with the chapters on the people is that I kind of used a bit of kind of years of reading rock profiles and years of doing them to an extent. Like, I once went to Brett Michaels' house in Sherman Oaks in Hollywood and tried to kind of tell people what he's like as a guy. You know what I mean? We played pool, and I tried to read his personality from playing pool in his pool room. You know what I mean? Amateur psychology. That's what, you know, journalists do who write features on people, right? I really enjoyed Quayle and I enjoyed Arco. But I think with the chapter on John Rebo, I tried to communicate my own confusion as to, like, I couldn't sum him up easily.
Yeah, yeah. Like
stuff about, like, there's people mentioned, like, Roy and John. And I, like, let's say, so for my relationship with John Rebo is that, you know, during the Super League war, I'd ring him up, but he always answered his phone. Obviously, Roy worked at the Herald, so I would see John Rebo socially occasionally. And then when the Storm started, I went to a lot of Melbourne games. Okay, so I would see him coming into games at the Turnstile. I'd see him in a corporate room, and you know, we had like a rapport, like a, you know, just like a bloke I know. You know what I mean? A bloke I know from footy. You know what I mean? So when it was time to actually do this book, I felt it was my duty to tell someone who's never met him what he's like. That's what you do, right? The chapter on John Quayle is supposed to tell you what I think he's like. Chapter on Ken Arpison is supposed to tell you what I think he's like, you know? And the chapter on John Rebo, it was a different, I had to change pace completely from just knowing him as a bloke to try to be a journalist and try to, and you know, and what I did is I sent him his quotes. And he said, I don't think I could do this. And that's because he just read his quotes. And I said, well, I'm not just going to plonk all your quotes in, but I'm not going to show you what I've written about you, because then I'd have to show everybody what I've written about them as well. The book will never come out. You know what I mean? So he was fine with that. And then he was fine with the quotes. I think maybe for memory, it's a few years ago now, there's a few quotes he didn't want to go in because they were critical of other people or whatever, and he took them out. My way of operating is, I'm not going to volunteer to send you your quotes, because then I'd never write a story. But if you want to withdraw something that you remember you said, or you've asked me what that you said, you can withdraw something you said. You can't. You've got no provenance over providence over what I say or what someone else says. But you've got providence over what you've said. You know. So anyway, I sent him the quotes. He took some out, I think, that he just didn't want to say, that, which is fair enough, that weren't, maybe he didn't like what he said about someone else. And I don't remember the specifics, honestly. And then I wrote the chapter just trying to communicate my own navigation of him as a person, and how I tried to draw him out, and how he was reluctant in some areas. And like him and Roy spoke about, you know, his dad coming back from war and being kind of, damaged by being, you know, in the war and stuff like that. And I thought it was nice, like, you know, he talked about Arco, how, you know, which he has spoken about elsewhere, about Arco saving his career, taking him over to Manly, and about them, you know, going to a funeral together and kind of embracing at the end of it and stuff like that. And I really think a lot of people maybe can't imagine what it would be like to be John Rebo, but I kind of can. I can imagine what it was like to feel you're a revolutionary, but really, and you are, you know, so many things we still have today. But in the end, with anyone who gets big business on side, they've bitten off more than they can chew, and they're at the mercy of it. So, you know, I don't want to go on and on, but since I've moved over here and stopped being just a journo who clocked on and clocked off, I've kind of found myself trying to get into that world a little bit, where you have an idea and then you try to sell the idea and get people on board and get other people in the room, and it's so complex and it's so hard, and it becomes, once you involve one other person in your dream or your vision, is the word, that's our word, isn't it, you lose control of it. Yeah. As soon as you get one bloke who says, I know someone who can do some posters for you, well, they can draw up some posters for you, you've lost a bit of control of your vision. Okay, when you get someone rich to finance it, it's kind of, your vision survives at their pleasure, at their behest, you know. That's in answer to your question about that chapter. That's kind of, I found John to be hard to read. Yeah, of all the people I interviewed at length for the book, he was the hardest to read. Yeah.
Yeah. Sums it up quite well, just that the, what I'd say would be the botched execution of Super League from April 1 onwards. Like,
well, you think it was botched in Australia. Come over here. Here. I mean, they just blew 87 million pounds, and they've still got, you know, Cass and Wakey and all these places, you know, Cass falling apart, and half the clubs in the Super League not being able to spend up to the cap, You know what I mean? They just blew the money. So I think if you think it was botched in Australia, spend 5 minutes here over here, you know.
Do you think it's as simple as the money going to a, you know, this the RFL, like a central board, and being administered that way rather than going straight to the clubs? Do you think
that was the answer? I think it was the people. I think it was the resistance to mergers and the resistance to, you know, even now I have conversations on social media with people. If Calder had have been launched in 1996, would they have fans now? Would they have won? Would they have been to Old Trafford?
Yeah,
you know what I mean. If there was a Cumbria Super Club, would they have fans? Would they have survived? Would they, you know? And people, and that goes to another thing, which, you know, here they just have this superstitious belief in the purity of sport. And this is the home of the least pure sports competition, really, in the world, where the team's full of people from elsewhere. They all live in gated communities and get paid, you know, £100,000 a week, and they get traded like horse meat. And yet they still have this belief that the team represents, you know, their apartment block. You know, that it's as pure as it was in 1860. You know, so. What works in Australia, you know, doesn't work, or America doesn't work here. And I think the fans basically said, I know the fans basically said that, no, we're not going to support any new invented entity in our heartlands. And there hasn't been one since. Unlike in Australia, where we're, you know, expanding to Papua New Guinea, and we've got a team, got Melbourne Storm have been, the Dolphins are more an English thing where they existed before. But there's still no, that I can think of, there's still no new franchisee, new world entity that's come into existence in the heartlands here. So basically, the Aussie and American ideas of setting up sports teams, the fans back in 1995, 96 said, we don't want that on our doorstep. Obviously, I mean, there have been sham mergers like, Sheffield merged with Huddersfield and played all their games in Huddersfield. So then Sheffield had to start again. Or Gateshead merged with Hull and they were allegedly the Hull Sharks or whatever. But no, actually they were Hull, and then Gateshead had to start again. So that's about the only things that have happened here. So that's why it happened here, because the society just wasn't, and the fan base wasn't ready for it. Mm. That's what I think. And still aren't. You know what I mean?
I don't think anyone was ready for the coming together of the English game and the Australian game with the World Club Challenge in 1997, which some of the stories you got of that tournament were just amazing. I think that those are the kind of the stories that do become, you know, like, you know, the Johnny Raper bowler hat. Like there were about 100 bowler hats metaphorically in England with some of the stories you were able to draw out. You didn't go over to England in
97. No, no. Tony, my good friend Tony Adams did, and they say that he still covered it all from his hotel room. He didn't go to any games. Yeah, he'd be staying in Leeds, and someone would be at Bradford and get a call from him. I said, "What? You're up late?" "No, I'm in Leeds." "Why aren't you here?" but Tony doesn't drink either, which would have made it a bit boring for him. But I didn't. I was in Australia, and I actually remember. I think there was a State of Origin in Melbourne the same week as Canterbury and Wigan played at Belmore. I used to just love buzzing around and trying to do impossible trips, just challenge myself, but to do impossible trips. So I actually left Belmore at half time. I think, I don't know if Wigan were behind or in front, and then flew to Melbourne. And then by the time I got to Melbourne, I learned that Wigan had beaten Canterbury. But I loved it for that reason. I think it's kind of a lot of us are on the spectrum in some of the things we do. And the thing that I'm on the spectrum with is like logistical kind of things. Even though I'm quite disorganized, when it comes to travel and stuff, I try to do impossible things, you know, and it's just fun to me. So having two competitions was amazing because they didn't talk to each other, but I would zigzag between them and, you know, try to walk in right as the game is kicking off, or try to write an impossible amount of words before deadline and not, you know, and still not get the score wrong. And I just used to challenge myself. And so having two competitions was just a godsend for that little autistic man on my shoulder. You know, they're kind of like, if that's not disrespectful to anyone, I hope it's not. But you know what I mean? Those little picadillos that I had. I loved there being more games, more press conferences, more training sessions. You know, I loved it, you know.
You know, maybe not a good enough reason to stage the tournament just for that. But
well, the great thing was the way it was organised, right? So the way it was, you know, like where, you know, Penrith had to, like Penrith, what was it? The great when Penrith played St Helens.
Yeah.
St Helens hadn't won a game and Penrith hadn't lost a game, but St Helens went through.
Yeah.
Because the margin.
Yeah.
The margin wasn't big enough, you know.
Yeah, so like they were on the field celebrating at the end of the game.
I used to go to a place called Barron's and which is in the Cross.
Oh yeah, no,
and
well.
I love the place. In fact, I got a phone call when it closed, the night it closed, I was driving up the coast to driving up to Queensland, and I got a phone call of someone saying, "Where are you? It's the last night at Barron's." It was Theo Anast. I don't know if you remember him. He's a Canterbury player, played for France. Yeah. It's used to come and crash parties and play his acoustic guitar. He wanted to be Bob Dylan, but I used to sit. I sat in the window at Barron's, and I remember one night. I won't name the team, but if you've been to Barron's, you know there used to be a sex shop straight across the road, right? And I remember sitting there and seeing an entire Super League team walk out of the sex shop. And another time, I was at the Bourbon and Beefsteak. I used to sit next to late Greg Groudon at the Herald, and the rhyming slang was Durban for bourbon, bourbon. You know, you've been to Durban lately, you know. He used to go to both, you know. I had a girl I was seeing at the time, I remember I introduced her to Andy Gregory during the World Club Challenge, and she was a similar height to Andy Gregory, and he just put this sloppiest kiss on the lips, like must have gone for 2 minutes. At which point I just grabbed her on the shoulder and left, you know. It was already, he didn't do anything. That was it. She was happy to kiss him. It wasn't like unconsensual. It was just a bit longer than I expected, you know what I mean? So I just remember, like, so that was a great thing about, That was a good, great thing about that period, was that I lived it kind of. So it was kind of quite an emotional journey to go back and talk to everybody and go back for all the record, you know, the records and stuff. And I'm sure when I do this 94 Kangaroo book, it'll be the same. It's like, well, you know, you're going to go on a road trip in Australia. Why not stop in on the Chief, you know? Yeah. why not stop in and under the pretense of doing a book and catch up with a bunch of people, you know?
Well, I wanted to ask you about it actually, because after reading Touchstones, I guess I was expecting a slightly different slant, and I wasn't prepared for how much of a background character you were in Two Tribes. I thought it was going to be more, you know, the Steve Mascord story of 1997, but you really took a back seat to, you know, the greatest story.
Mate, it's not I did my training at AAP, so you never wrote the word I. You get kicked out of the building. Yeah. At AAP if you wrote the word I. And so my first instinct is actually not even to try to write well. My first instinct is just to try to arrange facts as simply as possible. First part telling people something, second part the context, and third part a quote. That's my favorite type of writing, you know. And so I guess I'd read a few before I did Touchstones. I'd read a few kind of those sort of books, like Chuck Klosterman and stuff like that, Nick Hornby and stuff. And I read it and I thought, well, that seems like a lot of fun to have a go at doing that. I'm going to have a go at that, bugger it, you know. And actually, you know, it the first print run went. Was gone. Second print run was one of the worst decisions I think Jeff Armstrong has made in his entire life. You know, they're all still sitting around. They've been used to hold away floodwaters in various parts of Australia, boxes of Touchstones. But it was a great experience. And so, no, then the second time I wanted to be a piece of journalism, and my objective was pretty similar to yours, I think, probably, you know.
Just one thing that I read in the book, you were talking about you're a 27-year-old reporter with a strict agency background, talking, you know, what you've just said. When, you know, see you with the long hair, the, you know, the skinny face, the, you know, it's crazy how young you were. But I actually have claims to have, between 94 and 1998, I probably read everything you wrote, you know, in the last few years. And something I noticed in your writing in that period is, I think, like, 95, 96, the way I characterized it was, like, you were the kind of the day-to-day guy, and then Roy was, like, the bigger picture, you know, like, the bigger story, the analysis. But I feel like 1997 and definitely into 1998, I was definitely seeing a lot more of that in your writing then. Is that something you were conscious of then, like a kind of like growing maturity or a change in your role in what you were writing about the game?
I had editors who were hassling me to do it, but because to be more kind of in depth or whatever, or as Steve Meacham, who was a sports editor around the Olympics, said, a considered piece. But no, you know what happens? Like at first. And this is what I think the kids doing podcasts and stuff now sort of don't, and maybe they don't need to know this, right? Maybe it doesn't apply anymore. But the more people know what you think about an issue, the more people who won't speak to you as a reporter because they already know what you think. So I won't try to come up with some stupid example, but you know, anyone listening knows that if I think Vegas is a joke, then Peter Volandi's maybe won't answer the phone to me around the time everyone's talking about Vegas, right? So I thought it was best not to throw opinions around willy-nilly because I thought it hurt me as a reporter and my ability to do my job as a reporter. But then you start to feel quite beyond editors who say, you know, like I would always do a match report. If someone blew up afterwards, said something great, that was always my lead. You know, I would never bury that. Whereas, you know, I had editors who would prefer I wrote a match report as just a piece of writing and put Ricky Stewart blowing up or whoever his equivalent was back then in the 14th paragraph, you know, or write something kind of quirky about him blowing up rather than just that he blew up. But then after a while, when you get older, you start to feel that you're seeing things that other people aren't seeing because you've been to 500 games. And you've seen coaches come and go. You've seen administrators come and go. You've seen the sport make the same mistakes over and over again. And then it becomes like a sense of responsibility. There's a guy who's got this thing in America, and he's like independent. He's like a right-wing sports guy. His name's what's his name? Anyway, he's got this empire, and he says, why do sports reporters do this? Why do they do that? I get more hits and more followers by doing things this way. And the one thing he misses is four words, a sense of responsibility. You know, like a lot of people are working in the media now, they get told how to do things but not why. And the biggest, and if you haven't got a sense of responsibility, then I don't think you're a journalist, you know. And so after a while, I started seeing the same things over and over again, and I felt like I had a responsibility to point at things out because I'd seen them a number of times and it seemed that most people hadn't, or they weren't conscious of it, they hadn't paid attention. So then it was actually good that my editors had been asking me to write more considered pieces because suddenly I had something I wanted to write a considered piece about. So I was able to do it. You know what I mean? But I've never been interested in, Reese Walsh's leaving the Broncos to sign with the Dragons
I'm very interested in Reese Walsh leaving the Broncos to go to the Dragons.
I've got bad news for you. He's not. but you know what I mean? But I've always been interested in the game and stuff and that's been my team has been rugby league, team rugby league. So if I thought team rugby league's front office was stuffing up, then I would feel, you know, indignant. So that's why it kind of happened. I'd worked through the Super League War, and I appreciate you caring enough to ask me this question. I'd worked through the Super League War, and I'd seen administrators, and I'd learned a lot about human nature and what motivates people and how people can be duplicitous when there's money or prestige or fame or power up for grabs. And so I just felt I had a sense of responsibility to communicate that I'd feel derelict in my duty if I didn't. So that's why maybe you got more of those pieces, maybe. Yeah.
I wanted to talk to you about the ending of, or who you kind of, you know, gave the last word to, because that was something we really struggled with is, you know, we had all these quotes and all these sources. How do we wrap this up? And you went with, with Newcastle and the Chief. And can you talk a bit about your thought process and whether you know that was always the idea, or what about that story made you decide to kind of make that the end point?
Well, I think that one of the first lines, maybe in the foreword, is if this was a book, if this was a book. One of the first lines in the movie is if this was a book. No. One of the first lines in the book is if this was a movie. Maybe in the movie it would go, some guy will stand there and go, if this was a book. If this is a movie, it will kind of start, I think, in Newcastle. And I thought really that the story that we're trying to pull together is what is rugby league, really? That's what we're trying to figure out. And how was that exposed by this episode, right? And I think if you think anyone thinks about it carefully, it was Newcastle that exposed what rugby league is, and Newcastle that kind of brought things back together in a messy way, but it's still a poetic way, you know, messy poetry where all the words don't necessarily rhyme. And so I always thought that if it was a movie, Paul Harrigan would be like, he was a Luke Skywalker. You know what I mean? He was the one who was he spoke to both sides. He drove the bus. He was badly injured and concussed during that season. So he was wrought and tormented and drawn and quartered physically, intellectually, and emotionally during that year. And he was there for the beginning and he was there for the end. So I always had it in my mind that it would finish. I would write about him at the end. And for the conversation to be the way it was, I got goosebumps now thinking about it. And when the book first came out, when I talked about it, I actually got emotional. Like I think it maybe when they were filming, I haven't seen the documentary yet. But when I was talking about this on the film, it was like look at this idiot. Like he just wrote a book and he wasn't even there and he's sitting there like almost crying about something that someone told him. But that's the way I felt about it, like that chapter. Paul Harrigan said the people who started rugby league in the Hunter were descended from the coal miners in Yorkshire, and they knew what the game was about, and they knew what a fight was about. You know what I mean? And so the whole thing, I mean, the metaphor of the journey, of the crusade, of the bus, the people waiting in the outer suburbs of Newcastle, it's like Greek mythology. You know, it's like it's got so many sort of it's got a kind of resonance that goes back to the storytelling, you know, goes back as long as there's been stories. So I just kind of think that it was obvious that he was a central sort of character, and I guess that a tendency to see a narrative in the smallest thing is a blessing and a curse for me. I can kind of see, I've told this story before. I mean, I don't know, like you might think it's ridiculous, but I'm adopted and I met my uncle, and my uncle, the first day I met him, he told a story about crossing the road as if it was like, the Ten Commandments, or as if it was like, Jason and the Argonauts, you know? And I kind of thought, I thought that must be something that kind of runs in our blood a little bit. You know, he talked about other things like, you know, how, you know, anyway, other things, physiological things, and like you do when you meet relatives that you haven't seen in a while, or your long lost twin or whatever like that. And I kind of thought, well, is that something that runs in the family, or is it me seeing that, my ability to see a narrative where there is none? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I always saw a narrative in Paul Harrigan. And that year, and I thought he was the kind of like he was the Luke Skywalker, he was the star of the year, and that if there was ever a movie made, it'd be like, you know, fame or something. You know, it would be, but it'd start in the steel mills with the hot iron being hammered. You know what I mean? That's just the way I saw it. You know,
I got to say, I had goosebumps then listening to you speak, as I remembered Paul's chapter in the book and that 6 minute soliloquy that that he gave you. And thinking also to the chapter we did recently on that 1997 grand final, which I don't think I'd really reckoned with it. You know, it was a great game. I'd seen all the scenes in Newcastle. I knew about the steelworks and all these kind of threads that you keep hearing. But it wasn't until like just hearing people like Paul Harrigan speak about it and knowing like how real it was, it's just you're right, like there's really no other way to end it, is there? It's just like, what would have happened if Manly beat them? Like where would we be now, you know?
I don't know. I mean, it would have been harder to win people back, but I mean, Ben Everill, who's a good friend of mine who lives in the States now, who used to be a referee and a reporter, you know, he said Vegas,
Ben, he's the golf reporter, isn't he?
He said the game is back to where it was in 94 now, and I think it was a great observation. Whether we'd still have to wait another couple of years if Manly had won the grand final, I don't know. But you know, like, you know, these are kind of things that, you know, like the great thing is that I guess when I started the book, I was a little bit cynical about, you know, I've been doing this for years and I moved over here and I kind of was cynical about journalism. I was cynical about rugby league. I think my first year here, I only watched 10 NRL games on TV in the whole season. And this kind of like, you know, reminded me by talking to other people whose lives had been defined, and defined is probably not good, but whose lives had been changed by the game. It reminded me how that had happened to me. And all these people I knew, I had 85% of my friends, maybe, I met through rugby league, or maybe, you know, a lot, 85%. And so if I would turn my back on rugby league, I'd turn my back on 85% of my friends, kind of, you know, which a lot of people do. They leave, you know, over here, there's people who played, well, there's people everywhere, played 20 tests and don't even watch the game anymore. It was such a great experience, you know, for me just to remind, it's a middle-aged kind of thing where you want to leave your past behind and you don't want to be defined by your past. And so it's just the same as I kind of tried to have the game come to terms with 1997. It allowed me to come to terms with how I spent, you know, 30 years of my life, you know what I mean? Oh, you know, and make peace with it and celebrate it and try to repurpose it for the future. So if Manly hadn't, you know, if Manly hadn't, I mean, Touchstones didn't sell that well, so I'm sure people don't want to hear me talk about myself now. But I mean, just as far as focusing, it was a good focus for me as well on what happened before and what the future might hold. And I think it's also the same for kind of the game and also the game's fans. You don't know where you're going unless you know where you've been. And so it was like therapy for me, you know, to spend that at exactly the right time to spend sort of a couple of years doing that book, you know?
Yeah. And I think this was, you know, from my end, like we've done 40 chapters and a lot of acrimony and clubs going under and, you know, a lot of bad things happen to the game. But within it, there's just so many, like, great stories, so many good things, so much progress or foundations for progress, and for me, like, it's not even like what happens in the game, it's the glimpse into humanity that Super League provided. Yeah.
But that's what the, like, that's what I kind of like, that's what the job kind of is, I think. Like I listen to these podcasts now, and these people are talking about, you know, tackles in the opposition 20, and they know how many minutes each player should, each edge back rower should spend on the field, and you know, and all this sort of stuff. I'm like, I'm blown away by the knowledge that these kids have, and I've got to say, a lot of it. I'm interested in their interest. I'm not interested in that stuff myself. I never kind of have been. It's always been about, you know, what the 80 minutes I've just seen, or the press conference I've just seen, or the event that just happened tells me about people. You know what I mean? And about, you know, and what does it reveal about all of us, you know? And so that was always kind of the thing where, you know, and that's the way I kind of approached the book, but it's the way I always approached kind of journalism. I'm not saying if someone goes, the referee missed a forward pass, it should be dropped next week, that tells us, or it does tell us something about humanity, but it's kind of boring. We learned it a long time ago, you know, but I'm not saying everything I've ever written is about the human condition. But when you're doing a longer piece, you know, that's kind of what you're looking for. You're looking people to reveal. The thing I always say is reveal something about themselves that they don't intend to, plan to, sometimes want to, you know.
I'm really dirty on Ben for what he said about 1994, because that was my big finale for our last episode. Is that I think that's where we're at too. Like, I feel, and I don't know how the crowd figures and TV ratings. I you know, the data could say it's a completely different scenario, but it just feels like something is in the air. Like, culturally, it just feels like rugby league is back, and I feel like it's in a really good place. And you know, I was at the Golden Valley Hotel in Enmore a few weeks ago, Saturday afternoon, Manly versus the Dragons. The front bar, like, it was packed with people. The sound was on at the rugby league, you know, in an inner west pub. Whereas 5 years ago, you'd be lucky if they weren't showing the AFL, and you know, there'd be no sound. And I just feel like we're kind of back in this moment, and I don't know what it is, but what I wanted to ask you was, are we kind of on the continuum from 1994? Did Super League put a handbrake on progress that was coming? Did it lay the foundation for growth ahead? Like, is
Well, I think
this?
I think like there's an argument, you know, which I've heard furthered by like Spiro Zavos and people, you know, that rugby league only became the most popular sport in Sydney because they played through the First World War. And I'm trying to remember, I asked a historian that, and he said it was completely incorrect that rugby league was on top of rugby union before in its first 3 years. It was on top of so really. As much as we might like to venerate PVL or Arco or Quayle or anyone like that, Kevin Humphries, really they are custodians to keep it there, really. And so what is big in Sydney is not what it was in 1911. You can't be big in Sydney and have no presence anywhere else. You can't just have a local competition now. You know, because that you just can't, it doesn't work. That's not the way the media is, society, technology, communication, blah, blah, blah. So really, it's incumbent upon whoever is running the game in Australia to keep it where it was in 1911. Like it depends on your where you are watching it from. So if you're watching in Melbourne, you go, wow, it's much bigger than it used to be, you know, or Perth, much bigger than it used to be. But so I think it is at the center. So it's rugby league has been at the center of pop culture in Sydney for varying levels for 120 years, 116 years or whatever. Maybe the first year it wasn't so big, or the second year it wasn't so big. So you know, I think it's more just a matter of degrees of once you're at the top, then you know when you're number one on the charts. It's a matter of how many records did you actually sell then. If you're always number one, let's try and sell more records, you know. I think rugby league is back right at the center of pop culture in New South Wales and Queensland now. And then it's a matter of like making the returns bigger and flushing out the resistors, the people who still don't like it, you know, who might be you know, living down at Paddington, hanging out in pubs in Paddington where it's still turned down, or the Swans are on, or something like that. You know, so let's, you know, it's great that the game is back to where it was before the war, but there's still, you know, there's so much to be done. You know, as far as a national footprint, obviously the international game is something that the NRL are taking an interest in suddenly in the last few years, and something that they'll probably, I think, take open control of in the years ahead. I think the British game is also something the NRL is taking an interest in, and there could be some really big changes over here in the next few years. And so, yeah, it's just onwards and upwards. And it's a funny thing to say we've got to pick up where we left off in 30 years ago. Pick up where we left off 30 years ago, and then we can do another podcast series on where we'd be if it never happened. Yeah. Where, you know what I mean? Would the Steelers still be around? I don't know. You know? So, yeah.
I guess the second part of that question leads you to your next project, which is, you know, you're looking at the 1994 Kangaroo Tour, and it's just assumed, like, if you're talking about the good old days, or, you know, the last time rugby league was truly pure and great, it's always 1994, everything was perfect, and then it all fell apart. But, like, was it really that great? You know, like, it's something we spent some time interrogating, and I'm assuming you've spent some time thinking about that question.
As we're recording this, your episode on that is airing on rugbyleague.com, actually. So yeah. some people are hearing that for the first time, and they'll probably hear this in about 2038, same people. mate, I don't know. Like, I still look at it a little bit from a personal point of view, and I'm actually going through clippings at the moment. My late mother, I bought back, went to my storage room in Moore Park, and I bought back a big, my mum used to cut out all my clippings and put them in this binder. And when things went online, she started printing them out and putting them in the binder. I'm like, the fact they're online now means you don't have to do that anymore. You know what I mean? But she still did. I wasn't going to stop her. So anyway, so I'm looking at 1995, and the Super League War is happening, and the World Cup is coming up, and the State of Origin is only has ARL players and stuff like that. And certainly things were pretty, they were pretty stuffed a year later. And I guess the subplot to 1994 is that, and this is probably, you know, you read earlier what my wanky objective was with Two Tribes. My wanky objective with this one is to maybe discover what was happening below the surface in 94, when we all thought everything was, you know, we all the surface was glassy, and I guess it'd be good to find out, you know, what was happening below the water waterline, because I remember, you know, Arco coming home from the 94 Kangaroo Tour because to put out this fire, and I remember, I mean, I was told that something was going on very early, and it was in a social setting. And I couldn't write it, and I didn't, you know. So I sort of asked myself those questions, about, you know, about what is journalism? What do I owe to my readers, as opposed to what do I owe to my friends? You know what I mean? And what was my ethical obligation at the time? I don't even remember exactly when I was told or what I knew. So I guess kind of like it's pretty much the same as Two Tribes. It's a piece of journalism, but where I can kind of almost interview, you know, my 20-something-year-old self as well, and find out, what did you know? You know, but I'm looking forward to it, mate. But I'm so busy at the moment with this radio thing that I've interviewed Tim Brasher so far, and Tim Brasher was someone who I always thought was very wary of the media, and so I was very surprised at how great he was.
Yeah,
and he makes himself he does a lot of podcasts. And he was awesome. He was just so good and quite sort of philosophical and stuff. But I'm so busy at the moment that I'm like, I still haven't even transcribed all of Tim Brasher.
Yeah.
So I think I'm going to have to come and do this, like just basically get a rental car and just go around and just grab as many guys as I can. And of course, we already lost the first player from the tour. And then Two Tribes, we've lost so many people, you know, like, Bozo and Paul Broughton and Peter Mulholland. And, you know, I mean, if I update the dedication bit at the front, every time I do a addendum or a re-edition, it's going to need, you know, more and more space. And, you know, when I was younger, I thought, I just want to go out and talk to a bunch of footy players before they die and just write a book full of, I realize that, like, there's a commercial aspect to book publishing, and people aren't necessarily going to buy a book because you've got a chapter with Chimpy Bush in it. You know what I mean? Like, you've got to actually have a concept you know, you've got to have an idea. So, but yeah, so yeah, anyway, so yeah, so as far as I think 94 was great, and my memories of it are wonderful. My memories of a tour are amazing. Peter Frelinghuis said to me, you know, this is going to be one of the greatest experiences of your life. And I was like, already cocksure, you know, 25-year-old. I was like, I've been overseas. I was like, this bloke's never been anywhere. He's had no experiences. Trippy. He just goes to football. You know, I've been to bloody Hollywood. You know, I've been to the Grand Canyon. You know, and I realised that it's got nothing to do with the places. Yeah. Obviously, Cass and Halifax is places like that. But it's about the experience of people having breakfast with the same people every day, getting to know people, you know, really well, having cars break down and stories to tell you know, and now we're at that age where, you know, obviously Chippy's long gone and Paul Malone, we lost a couple of years ago. It's horribly sad. So it's just time. It's time to kind of get everyone's recollections between a couple of covers and have it sit there on the shelf for forever, you know. So, yeah, so it's but time is something I don't have a lot of.
Yeah, right now, well, you know? I can't wait, but it seems like I'm going to be waiting a while.
Yeah. I don't know where this. I don't imagine I'm going to be sitting in here slotting in ads forever. You know what I mean? Like I am now. Like we're going to get more automated, and then we're going to be doing live stuff as well. So we're going to be doing calling matches and stuff.
Can you maybe just give a little intro to this new project just for our listeners?
Yeah, it's good. So it's the Mount Rushmore of URLs, rugbyleague.com. And it's basically a 24-hour rugby league radio station, which has been tried before, but it's got a little bit of a basis because the guy running it actually does the perimeter advertising at 9 of 12 Super League clubs. He's been around the game for 25 years. He was a guy who started Kent Invicta, which features in Anthony Broxton's book.
Yeah,
he's mentioned it. Paul Fares, he's in Anthony Broxton's book actually. So we're up and running now with podcasts playing out. Jason Costigan is living in Paul's spare room in northern Spain and doing news bulletins about everything from Nathan Cleary's not playing to Ukraine have changed their coach and everything in between. And then on top of that, we've got the rights for London and Catalan's games. We were taking 2GB NRL, but it turns out that we'd started talking to him about it. The T's weren't crossed, I's weren't dotted, so we had to take that down for a little bit until that's sorted. So it's a 24-hour rugby league radio station. And I guess if it's too successful, the big boys will try to run us out of business because that's the way this works, yeah. As we now know.
that's really cool. And I'm very thankful for including us on it. It's another way to get the word out about our show. But yeah, so that's great stuff. Really looking forward to the book.
Oh, can I ask you a couple of questions? Because I once asked a guy, Andrew Mueller, who's a rock critic, who's from Australia, lives here in London. I asked him if he ever kind of felt, as he got older, guilty about some of the more scathing criticism that he'd levelled at bands. And he said, no, you know, that's the job, that's criticism, you know. But I just wonder with you, kind of like being younger and one of you being a comedian, whether, I don't know, like whether you ever felt like as you mentioned irreverence in one of the last episodes, the word irreverence. I just wonder, like, was the irreverence and the level of the irreverence something you had to grapple with during the course of the, because I've kind of been a bit, I guess I've been quite serious over the last, we've been on about 90 minutes, I guess. I've been quite serious over the last 90 minutes and even kind of like even maybe a little bit kind of emotional and stuff, which is a different tone to what your show normally is because you've got a comedian sitting next to you. So how do you grapple with kind of like that reverence and irreverence?
To me, it's about the respect for the game. And I think what we do is we put in the work. And I don't think anyone who listens to us could have any doubt about our love for rugby league and our respect for rugby league history. And to me, like if you lay that foundation, I don't worry about the irreverence because I know personally for me and Andy, it comes from a place of love and I hope that's like reflected to the listeners.
100% it is, yeah, 100%, 100%. And you've kind of stumbled across a format as well, kind of, haven't you? Which was very, which sort of struck a chord with people. Like, instead of doing fancy production and stuff and music and stuff like that, your fancy bit was your research. You know what I mean? So it felt informal because you had that base. And so clearly, other people like the kind of trying to think of some grunge bands that weren't very successful. But you know, there's a few Nirvana copycats out there who, you know, who've come and gone. But I got the feeling that like Kurt Cobain, you didn't set out to be a rock star.
I'm a
Let's hope
librarian,
that.
mate. So yeah, very,
Yeah,
very
let's hope
far.
things end a bit better too, you know. So yeah.
Yeah, so far it's going a bit better.
Are you doing next? What are you going to do next? What's the next sort of thing, you know?
Finally, like, you know, going into the rock star thing, I've just getting the band back together. You know, I used to play in a band and had kids, and then this project came into it, and so that's all taken a back seat. And so I've just started playing music again, and I'm just looking forward to an activity that I can do that doesn't require like 700 hours of reading to get any output.
What if I was just ringing you up, if my sports editor said, you know, ring up this guy and ask him about his podcast, the first thing I'd ask you would be like, why you would like do this for free, like a leap of faith, and then at what point you got enough feedback to feel that it was justified to continue. And the addendum to that would be, did you end up doing a lot more than you intended because you got such a great response, or were you always going to do 8 million episodes? You know what I mean? Like, you know.
If you'd have sat me down and said, this is how much time it's going to take, this is how much of your life you're going to devote to it at the start of the journey, I would have said, okay, well, I don't have time for that. I'm out. And Andy
Yeah,
certainly
right.
wouldn't have signed up to what, you know, we'd put together. It just kind of grew out of control. And that's the biggest problem with this project has been that you get one account, and then suddenly someone else is saying something completely different, and you're just forced to like keep researching. And
Yeah.
but again, it comes down to the love of the game, and also just I really like the looking back at the culture of the 90s, Australian culture, and getting that snapshot. So to make the series what it is for us, it needed that like broader cultural element, which adds an extra
Yeah.
layer of time and research. So it if we'd have put it out and no one listened to it, like that would have been pretty brutal. But I think we found our audience pretty quickly, so it didn't really we didn't really have to grapple with that.
Is there another sort of period or subject in rugby league that you feel you could put a huge amount of time into?
I think eventually, yes. At the moment, I'm just like happy to have a bit of a break. But as it
Yeah.
turns out, I'm doing something for my work that's rugby league based, and so I was in the special collections area, and just happened to get a box. I don't know if you're familiar with JC Davis, the early 20th century journalist. But we've got a huge collection of his clippings and correspondence, and I was just looking for something very particular, and I found some letters that Duncan Thompson sent to Davis on the 1921 Kangaroo tour. Like, he wrote these letters from the ship, and he was talking about some bad incidents that happened. He didn't mention the incidents, but he said, "We're hoping we've put that behind us, and you know, we'll."
But that was before the invention of the helicopter, so we can cross that one out.
But yeah, so just like seeing Duncan Thompson's signature on a letter from you know the SS Tahiti, I think it was, that just like immediately, like, you know, that I got the hairs standing up again. And so never say never. I think I'm a researcher at heart, so we'll see what happens after a bit of a break.
You know what helps to be. It helps to be a little bit like, when I was a kid, I was talking about people are getting bored, but I used to go to there was a guy here, Dan Andruzic. I went out to dinner with him the other. He's a nuclear physicist. He's based in the US, Aussie guy. And he used to do this thing, rugby league international scores. And he used to keep all the scores before anyone did now. Again, before his time, you know, when Turkey played Serbia or whatever, or you know, Ireland students played someone, you know. And he used to keep them on. And he had this website, and he was really angry that the European Federation or the International Federation stole his idea of how the European the different levels, you know, European A, European B, and how you move between the levels. He said, I went and told them that, and they said it was a stupid idea, and then they nicked it. And, oh, that guy, I don't like you. I said, mate, you make stars in a laboratory, and you're worried that your idea for a rugby league competition with the average attendance of 35 was stolen. You know what I mean? And it's like, it's great to be, and you know, and I told him, I said, I used to spend my days off school. I'd go through the microfiche from 1908 in Wollongong Library, and I'd write down all the scores. Because it was actually, it was before David Middleton put out his book of records in about 83.
Yeah.
You couldn't, there was no way you could find the stuff, you know? And so I used to do all that stuff too. And you can never underestimate the benefit of being an outsider about that distance, use a rock metaphor again, the photographer's pit. It's good the photographer's pit is there, because if you're on stage next to the guys, maybe some of the magic disappears a little bit. So, you know, you're actually, and you know, so that was, but I kind of did, I guess I did, being a reporter and going on tours and stuff like that, I guess I did get close enough to become disillusioned. But I think people, when you're a reporter, people are on their best behavior around you, so you perhaps don't see the worst of people most of the time, and so I never really got disillusioned with the game because I was close to it, because I could see from being an outsider things that the people on the inside couldn't even see, and I could see that there was potential on the inside from my perspective outside, and there were things that they could do on the inside that could make it better. You know what I mean? So, and I think that's kind of what, you know, what your podcast is kind of all about, you know, is kind of like being able to laugh at it as an outsider, but still having that passion and not being disillusioned or jaded, you know, about it, you know. And it was great that you got to, you know, meet Ian Heads and go to his house and stuff like that, and that you still kind of, like I said, it's special to you. It's not something that is normal. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And just the journey of meeting so many people who, like, this matters, you know, like it's a silly game that doesn't matter, but like it matters when the cliche of, you know, going to games with my dad, taking my son to games, you know, like that's really important. But then just speaking to a guy who has 30 different Panthers jerseys, and you know, you know, like it's really cool, and it's just.
Here's a question for you, mate, and for the listeners, you know, is what could happen in rugby league to make you completely disillusioned with it? Like what secret could you find out that would make you go, I've been a fool to myself all these years. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I just can't see it. You know, like even the Dragons last weekend got beaten 60-18. Like it was horrendous, like awful. I got home and I was like, I'm not watching football the rest of this weekend. I can't deal with it. And I didn't watch the Thursday night game. I didn't watch the Friday night game. It was too painful to watch those games. Saturday evening comes around. It's like, what else am I going to be doing? So I put the Panthers Cowboys game on and moved on with it. Like I don't think it there's anything that could make me disillusioned with the game.
Yeah, yeah. I became a bit disillusioned when the person who was a CEO at Canterbury during the Ben Barber thing ended up getting the biggest job in the game. You know what I mean? I kind of just for reason, you know, and I, And I quit a lot of work at that time, and really, like, it was paved the way for me to, you know, to come over here. But that wasn't the game. That was obviously it was a certain group of people and a certain, you know, administration. And you know, obviously, if you learn, like, if let's say there was a big match fixing controversy where you learned that a number of games had been fixed, that would turn off a lot of people too. But I think what you did, I think when you with projects like, you know, Two Tribes or your podcast, you dig down into the kind of DNA, the sinew, the kind of thing that exists in everybody, you know, not in a bunch of individuals. You know what I mean? And that will be carried even if the administration collapses. If people say rugby league is going to die in England, what a heap of hogwash. Like, as long as someone loves it and someone knows the rules, someone pass the ball backwards. You know, someone can shout, "Get them on side!" Or the rugby league's not going to die. That's just an administration. It's just a bank account. You know what I mean? Like, you know. So, you know, and I think if you really want to be able to sort of future proof your passion for the game, you have to eventually get an appreciation for that, the stuff that exists in people's sinews. You know what I mean? And why it gets passed down?
Yeah.
Why? What is it? What is it? What is it that gets? You know, that makes you stand where your dad stand and your grandfather or in Australia sit. You know, that's that you've got to understand that. If you otherwise you are going to get disillusioned if you get ripped off by a referee or someone fixes a match or a player does something horrific in a pub, you're going to get disillusioned unless you have a deeper understanding. You know, we probably should finish with that, I guess.
that's a good place to end it. I'm so glad we could do this at last. So I didn't know I was going to get interviewed there at the end, but
it comes naturally. You know, and also you got mentioned in the book as well.
Appreciative of that.
Because I was listening to it at the time. Well, I appreciate you mentioning me on the podcast, let alone having me on for 4 hours like we've just had. So thank you. Thanks very much. The discount code, I'm trying to think. The discount code will still work if you just put in Rugby League Digest. I'll make sure it still works. But you've got to go, and this is a history and a pun all in one. Harold Horder with an A.com. That is where you can now get the book, because stevemaskell.com is being moved, so it's down at the moment. Harold, HOARDER.com. Put in the code Rugby League Digest, and you get the discount, whatever it was we agreed years ago. And if it doesn't work, just contact me on social media. I'm at Steve Mascord, and I'll fix it for you so you get your discount.
All right, cool. And I'll put that in the description for this episode. So anyone who doesn't have it already, rectify that immediately. But thanks so much, Steve. This was awesome. And really good to speak to you.
If I can help with anything in future, let me know. And it's great to have you on rugbyleague.com, where we're going right to the start of this, right back to the start. And as I said, in 2038, hello to everyone listening, if I'm still alive. Because it'll take us that long to catch up.
All right. Thanks so much, Steve.
Up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.